Zaxby's Sensation Salad is so much more than a plain old salad. It's a salad. Which begs the question, at what point does a salad stop being a salad and become a salad? Is it when you add Zaxby's fried chicken to it? Crunchy wontons? Asian slaw? Citrus vinaigrette? Teriyaki glaze? Sweet and spicy sauce? Or is it when you top it all with a handmade perfectly fried egg roll? Without a doubt, the egg roll. The Sensation Salad. Only at Zaxby's.
But on the plus side, maybe they'll finally realize what it's like to get unsolicited strangers at their door.
Hey! Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Let's understand each other. Stealing's wrong, okay? But if there's something you need bad, and you ain't got the money, then it's okay to take a loaner on the item. It's what you call an exception to the rule.
Hello, everybody. It's Wreckatopia, episode 146. And Aaron has not, over the holidays, quit his hobby of having something distracting on the screen as soon as I come up and start speaking. And I appreciate that, Aaron. Never change.
And do it for you, Chris. Change. Do it for you.
My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by the aforementioned Aaron Dicer.
Hidely-ho, Taterinos.
That's right. And also joined by Jeremy Scott.
Yes, sir.
There we go. There we go. We are also joined by chat. Hello, chat. It's been a long time. Are you guys okay out there? Happy New Year to you, all of you. Yes. But we'd like to welcome chat, who've come out here to watch us talk about movies and such on a Tuesday. And I say movies and such because I will start us off with our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
And I was given a book probably a year ago, and I've just kept it and held on to it forever and just never read it because I just don't have time, it seems like, sometimes. But I am carving out more time, I believe, this year to start reading some more books. And I have I read a book from Edward Zwick, director Edward Zwick, called Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. Edward Zwick has made movies that you know, like About Last Night from the 80s, Rob Lowe, Demi Moore. He did Glory. He did Courage Under Fire. He did Legends of the Fall. He did Last Samurai. He did Blood Diamond. He's got a pretty damn good list, I would say, of movies. He also served as showrunner for the show 30-something back in the day with his partner Marshall Herskovitz, and created My So-Called Life as well for its it's always interesting seeing where a guy got his start and what happened, how he got into whatever. And this one, it's funny, it's always about who you know, right? Because he wasn't like really anybody, but he kind of lucked into a show called Family in the 70s, and then that show didn't do all that well, but he started making connections and everything. And after a while, there was a point where he made one of his first movies. I think it was his very first movie. It was made for TV movie called Special Bulletin, which I watched. It's back in the 80s. Like, there were so many of these nuclear war scare-a-thon movies.
Yeah.
And this is another one. But this one's good, really, really good that he made. And then it shows how his career blossomed from there. He got About Last Night from that, and then went on to do Glory. What's really interesting about this, I wouldn't say he just comes out and gives you every single detail of his life or anything. He doesn't hold back in some moments either. Really interesting stuff about Denzel Washington in here, how it was like working with him. What went behind that shot, the famous shot in Glory when his character is getting whipped and the tear comes down his face. Really interesting stories there. How he learned how Denzel how he worked and everything. The story that Matthew Broderick was kind of a pain in the ass on Glory, and like what he had to go through on that. He's always like willing to tell you some negative stuff, but he always kind of pulls it back and says, you know what, we're friends now, this is okay, blah, 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 that type of thing. But just going through all these different things, and the Tom Cruise stuff is pretty wild too. And when he's talking about Last Samurai, anyway, if you really want to just a fascinating director talking about his own life in this book, find this book. It's very short. I read it in a couple days. So like 290, 300 pages, something like that. And it's really, really, really interesting. Really good stuff.
Somebody I follow, used to follow on Twitter, was reading this book and excerpting certain passages. This was a year or two ago, and everything I read was amazing. Everything I read was awesome. Like, I think beyond just the interesting stories, I think he's a really good writer. So I need to get this and read it.
Yep, absolutely.
Aaron, you or me?
One of you. Doesn't matter.
All right, I'll hop in. I'm going to hop in so I can get this over with and only be ridiculed for a second, but I'm going to recommend wholeheartedly Sonic the Hedgehog 3. I had so much fun at this movie. Now, I don't know what your take on 1 and 2 were, if you enjoyed them at all. But if you did, I think this is the best of the three. And I think it comes down to Jim Carrey has locked in to this role and gets to play double roles in this movie. And he had me rolling. He just has this special kind of comedy magic that he can put on screen that just works for me. It just works. And, you know, if this is, I think the way I would prefer to say it is, this is absolutely a kid's movie. Right. This isn't like you're not going to go in and get something really hugely deep and meaningful, maybe a little life lesson, whatever that kids movies do. But the thing is, it turned me into a kid. That's what happens with sometimes with these kids movies is I'm like, if I can vibe with them, I just have a great time. And Sonic 3, I think, is one of those movies. And I had a blast at it.
Well,
so.
Listen, it's an 86 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Great.
So I don't think you're really going to get much ridicule. I have seen the first one and loved it. I saw the second one and struggled. So I will probably watch this eventually. These movies collectively have made over $1 billion, so they're going to keep making more of them.
Yeah.
I liked the first one and I hated the second one. The second one, there's somebody at Paramount, and if you look, they're always Paramount movies, who's always trying to get an Indiana Jones stuck into a movie somewhere. And Paramount obviously did Indiana Jones back in the day. And they're always doing that. You look at it like Tomb Raider and all this. Mm-hmm. But Sonic the Hedgehog 2 is like an Indiana Jones, and it makes no fucking sense for it to be that, like, you know, and just the puzzles and everything. You're just like, huh, what, why is this the way it is? I've heard a lot of good things about 3, so eventually I will watch it. So
yeah, I had a great time.
All right, well, quite by chance, I watched a movie 3 or 4 days ago that I had never seen on HBO Max. I refuse to just call it Max. It's a 2020 film called Save Yourselves, but it has an exclamation point at the end, so I think it's Save Yourselves! This, you see the two main actors here in this shot. It's Sunita Mani, who I know from that Christmas movie, Christmas Carol with Ryan Reynolds and Will Ferrell, Spirited. And then a guy named John Reynolds, who I don't recognize from anything. This is basically a mumblecore rom-com with a sci-fi twist. I'm shocked there's not a Duplass name anywhere on the credits of this movie. So this is about a couple who have been together for a while, but they're struggling, but they both want to make it work. So they decide to go to his cousin's cabin, disconnect from the entire world. They leave voicemail outgoing messages telling everybody, hey, we're unplugging our phones. We won't have internet for a week. Wish us luck. We're going to go be one with nature. And about right about the time they shut their phones off, well, everything goes to shit in the world and there's an alien invasion and they don't know it for several days. And slowly they realize it and it kind of turns into a comic horror survival. It's never not quirky and funny. It's never too serious. And it has one of my favorite endings I think I've ever seen. I don't want to talk about it because it would absolutely spoil the movie. And I can't even tell you what happens at the end. Like, I could physically describe what's happening, but I don't know what it means any more than the characters do, and I love it. So I was really, really charmed by this. It's an 89 on Rotten Tomatoes, so I don't think I'm on too big of an island, but it's on HBO Max, and I just really, really enjoyed it. Aaron, have you seen this?
I haven't. I will put it on my list. I like John Reynolds. He is great in a TV show that most people missed called Search Party, which is a really fun show that went under the radar, and he's one of the main characters in that, and he's great. So, I'm excited to see this for sure.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I hope
saw an episode or two of that, and I never got back around to watching it. I need to get back on that one. So.
Yeah, it's a fun show. He was also in Yellow Jackets, but I don't remember who he was in that. I just saw that on his.
Oh yeah, I don't remember that either.
He probably got eaten in the first episode. All right, we're gonna go on to our big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
If you remember, 3 weeks ago, I said A Perfect World. So I hope you guys watched ahead enough time to watch this movie over the holidays. You may have needed all 3 weeks to watch this movie, as long as that ending is. Anyway, I'm going to get onto A Perfect World. Perfect World is a 1993 film directed by Clint Eastwood and written by John Lee Hancock. It is his follow-up to Unforgiven from the previous year. Our movie begins with Butch Haynes, played by Kevin Costner, lying in a field next to a Casper mask as a bunch of paper money swirls around him and a helicopter flies overhead. Or in other words, just another day in the life of mega movie star Kevin Costner. We then cut to a scene that proves once and for all that A Perfect World is a Halloween movie, since kids are trick-or-treating around the neighborhood. We are taken to the Perry House, where two girls and a boy fantasize about wearing costumes. Curiously, a bunch of trick-or-treaters living that dream ring the Perry's doorbell, whose dark house with no lights outside clearly indicates that they don't celebrate Halloween. We are told it's because they are Jehovah's Witnesses, but on the plus side, maybe they'll finally realize what it's like to get unsolicited strangers at their door.
Hey!
We find out the little boy in the house is named Philip Perry, played by T.J. Lowther. We now cut to a prison where we see Butch and his cellmate Terry, played by Keith Zarbajka. Don't know if I'm getting that right. Making an escape, and luckily a man named Larry, who just stopped by a minute ago, parks a car right outside a vent they escape through, and they subdue him and make him drive them out to freedom. Later on, Butch and Terry are driving Larry's car with a mysteriously missing Larry and argue about which car to steal next. They split up, and Terry breaks into the Perry House. Holy shit, everything rhymes! Terry first appears to just want some food, but it's clear he wants to do some bad shit to Mama Perry. As a neighbor spies the actions across the street, Philip walks into the kitchen and Terry hits him with his gun. Butch walks in and stops Terry from doing anything else, then instructs Philip to pick up the gun that Terry dropped and bring it to him. Just as Philip brings the gun over, the neighbor shows up with a shotgun, but the neighbor can't do anything while Butch has Philip in front of him. Butch and Terry decide to kidnap Philip so they can make their escape from the neighborhood, driving away as Mama Perry is left wondering how to get her son back. Now we're taken to a Texas Ranger office in Dallas, where we meet Red Garnett, played by Eastwood. A criminologist named Sally Gerber, played by Laura Dern, has been sent by the governor to assist with the kidnapping case. As with nearly every Clint Eastwood movie where he plays law enforcement, he hates anyone who isn't just looking to kick ass and take names and is apparently driven by politics. After a press conference, Bruce McGill shows him a trailer attached to a truck that Red will basically steal for his own headquarters during the manhunt, a trailer we are told will be used in a parade in Dallas that will eventually be JFK's demise. It also makes this movie perfectly synergetic with Kevin Costner and JFK and Clint Eastwood and in the Line of Fire. But more importantly, we now know we're in November of 1963. Oh yeah, also the feds are in on this manhunt, so we are introduced to Bobby Lee, played by Bradley Whitford, who's basically unrecognizable for a while. Tensions are rising between Butch and Terry just before they go to a store, where Butch gives Philip the gun and tells him to shoot Terry if he moves. While Butch is in the store, Terry tricks the kid and ends up with the gun again. But Butch secretly emptied the gun before giving it to Philip. Terry tries to hurt Philip, but Philip sinks his teeth into his arm and leaves the car with the gun and runs into a cornfield. Terry gives chase. Butch discovers no one in the car and sneaks out into the cornfield to find Philip before Terry does. Having bought some bullets at the gas station, he's able to load the gun. Soon, Terry runs into Butch and we hear a gunshot off screen, proving that in this field of dreams, Kevin Costner did not seek to ease Terry's pain. The gas station attendant brings a bat to a gunfight and can't do much to help the little kid, so Butch drives off with Philip. The incident is soon reported and Red, in his convenient trailer with all the amenities, is informed of his fugitive's last known whereabouts. An official road movie starts when we switch back to Butch and Philip. Philip is worried Butch might shoot him, but Butch assures him that they're friends and that he's a way better person than Terry. Next stop, a random Texas farm where Butch looks to ditch the car and find a new one. Butch gets Philip to see if the keys are in the car he's hoping to steal, and sure enough, this is the type of place where people are too lazy to take their car keys with them inside the house. Butch, though, can't just go car shopping. He has to go clothes shopping, too, and the farmer spots him but is unable to run him down before Butch drives off. Though the man tries his damnedest to T-1000 his car back, Philip's teeth strike again, and the man loses his grip. Red catches up to the scene where Butch stole the farmer's car and they open the trunk of the previous car, finding a dead Larry, in case you forgot about him. Butch takes Philip to get some pants and they come up with names to call themselves around other people. Philip chooses Buzz. While the sales clerk looks for the proper pants, Philip finds a Casper costume to wear. And as an aside, Clint Eastwood would later appear in the 1995 movie Casper in an uncredited cameo. Outside, a cop identifies the stolen car. Butch briefly leaves Philip to get the car, but the cops outside try to pin him in. But Butch is able to ram his way out of it. He then finds time to pick Philip back up, and we find out he shoplifted the Casper costume, and he's given the choice to stay or once again tag along, which he does. Butch finds a farm to hide out around while the pursuing and unsuspecting cops drive past. The plan seems now to go to Alaska for some reason. As Sally does some amazing psychological mumbo-jumbo position to flesh out Butch's character and to figure out where he might go next, we cut back to Butch and Philip in the car driving right past the trailer, and Sally notices not only the car but the kid wearing a Casper mask. A chase ensues, but the truck driving the trailer is unable to make deft maneuvers, and the trailer containing Red and the others unhitches, stopping the chase before it can really start. The trailer's momentum carries it away from the action, and it eventually crashes in the woods. Butch and Philip step away from the car to trick-or-treat, which Philip tells Butch he's not allowed to do, but Butch quickly gets him to forget about all that and have some fun. Philip even grabs Butch's hand in a sign that he's officially found his surrogate father. At the first house, the nice lady tells them since Halloween was last night, she's all out of candy. But Butch
What a nasty woman.
I know. But Butch indicates behind an unknowing Philip that his gun has more sway in this situation, and the lady goes inside to find something good to eat, which includes bread and onions. I think there's like onions. Oh, and also money. While making mustard sandwiches in the car, they drive past an idyllic picnic scene where a loving father tosses a ball to his son. Not long after, Butch stops the car to survey the road ahead and finds a roadblock. Philip, alone in the car, accidentally puts the car in reverse. When Butch tells him to hit the brakes, he hits the gas instead, towards the station wagon parked outside the picnic before taking a lucky turn and rushing past it. He finally finds the brakes and averts disaster. Butch, using the pseudonym of Edgar Poe, asks the picnic father, if they can get a lift in his station wagon since his car has such terrible brakes. Philip drives the car back to the station wagon where the movie puts us on edge that he's about to smash into it again before hitting the brakes just in time. The ruse works as they're able to get past the checkpoint in the station wagon riding with the other family. And they get an enlightening look at this perfect family when the mother freaks out about some soda getting spilled in the car and she yells at her son and daughter to the point of them totally withdrawing. After that, Butch just outright steals the station wagon. The family eventually goes to the checkpoint to tell the cops what happened. Butch learns more about Philip's sheltered JW life and decides the kid needs to have some fun, so he does what any responsible adult would do and ties Philip to the hood of the station wagon so he can experience a roller coaster. Then the movie has a for no reason section where Bradley Whitford sexually harasses Laura Dern and Clint can be a badass Clint and tell him off. At a restaurant, the waitress Eileen, played by Linda Hart, tries to seduce Tin Cup with a look down her blouse just before she deuces his buddy Cheech Marin and Tin Cup. It works, and Butch is able to get Philip to exit the restaurant so that the sex can happen. But Philip is a little peeping Tommy, and it ends that adventure early. A discussion about sex, love, and kissing backsides ensues. They stop by another cornfield for the night. Philip says he wants to go home. Shortly after, Butch asks him to make a list of all the stuff he's been denied in his short life. Around a campfire, Sally clues Red to the fact that she's done her research on him as well and ran across a case where he actually ran into Butch as a juvenile. He helps send Butch to juvie for 4 years for stealing a car because he was worried that he'd be sent back to his criminal father and have an even worse rap sheet than he does now. But the fact that he still didn't straighten out seems to mess with Red a bit. A Good Samaritan night worker, Mac, played by Wayne DeHart, shows up in the cornfield where Butch and Philip have parked and offers them a fold-out couch and a good breakfast in the morning, which they take. Once again, an idyllic scene is broken when Mac slaps his 6-year-old son after asking him to get something out of his truck and not going right away. Butch starts up a dance party to some Creole music with Mac's wife and the two kids, and one more time, someone in the room someone in the room hears some news position and knows that they have a fugitive in their midst. But Butch discovers it in time and threatens the man and his whole family. Just as they're about to leave, Mac, in the effort to protect his son, once again lets anger take control and starts hitting him. Butch intervenes and points a gun in his face and gives Mac a huge lecture. In fact, he might go a little overboard in teaching good fathering. And this is made even more explicit when he tells Philip to get some rope, and there's a more than tone-deaf scene where the rope is being cut in an almost teasing way towards a black man. Mm. Butch then uses the rope to bind his arms and legs. He seems to be flipping a coin whether to kill him or not. Then he puts duct tape over the entire family's mouths and duct tapes the mom and the kid together. This is really over the fucking top. Philip, understanding the evil, points his gun at Butch and shoots him in the stomach. Philip runs outside, throws the gun in the well, goes to the car, removes the keys and throws them away, and then runs. Philip finds a place to change directions by crawling through a barbed wire fence, which shreds some of his Casper costume and leaves a clue for Butch to track. A passerby notices Philip running in the field and calls the cops. It really is very little that takes this guy to call the cops, by the way. A little kid running in the field.
There's a kid running! Call 911!
I would understand if he saw Kevin Costner running after him in, like, anger.
He saw a ghost running in the field.
Oh, yeah, right. Someone. Ghost, right. Aaron, you're always there to get the
Thank
sanity.
Thank you.
Butch tries to chase Philip down and reason with him, but Philip climbs a tree to get away while Butch collapses next to it, tending to his wound. Butch pulls out an old postcard from his dad in Alaska that tells him that he didn't leave because of him and that he'd love to see him again someday, letting us know why Alaska is so important. And here comes the longest part of the movie, and I wish they shut it down. The cops arrive. The cops arrive en masse to the spot. Red tries to reason with him over the megaphone, but Butch threatens the kid's life. And I'm cutting a lot of shit out, by the way. But it's reasoned he doesn't have much leverage, and they send a helicopter with Mama Perry on it to get the kid to run to her. Butch offers the kid for some candy and whatever he has on his wish list. He finally lets Philip go. Philip makes it only partway before running back to check on Butch. He gives him a hug. They hold hands, walking back towards the cops. Red walks out to meet them. Butch reaches in his pocket to give Philip the postcard, which the trigger-happy Bobby Lee thinks is a weapon, and he shoots Butch in the chest. A trail of money seeps out of Philip's Casper suit. Red punches the fuck out of Bobby Lee. Laura Dern knees him in the balls for good measure. Philip and his mom get on the helicopter to go back home. We find out he's in the helicopter that he saw at the beginning of the movie as the movie bookends with the opening scene, and that is A Perfect World. Guys, what did you think of it?
I'm not sure he thought it was a weapon. I think that dude just wanted to kill him.
He wanted
to kill Butch.
Yeah.
I'll go, Aaron, if you're all right with that.
I grant you permission.
One of the things that I like about this movie, I hadn't seen this movie in probably 12, 15 years. But one of the things I like most about it is how real the story feels, to the point where I was Googling to find the book or the true life incident that inspired this movie, and it appears to be a complete work of fiction in film. But there are enough beats of it that ring true that sort of, you know, I don't know, it kind of feels authentic, like In Cold Blood or something. It feels like it could have been a true story. There's a doozy of a behind-the-scenes story on this film where Eastwood called Kevin Costner in his trailer to come to the set for a shot, and Costner said he wasn't ready. And since it was just a shot of his character walking through the field from behind, Eastwood shot it with Costner's body double. And Costner showed up, and Eastwood said, "We're moving on." And they had a huge argument on set where ultimately Eastwood said, "This is my set." And Costner never left the set again while anything was being shot because he didn't want things to be shot with his body double. I think that's amazing. This is two of the biggest powers in Hollywood. Costner apparently reportedly talked Eastwood into making this movie with him. And apparently they just butted heads the entire time. And
I just think about Kevin Costner after Dances with Wolves, what kind of like ego that put on that guy. I mean, considering also what we learned about Kevin Reynolds later on, his movies with Kevin Reynolds later on.
Yeah.
And I just sitting there thinking, even with Clint Eastwood, he's like, "I'm not going to let this old codger like run, like say anything to me right now. I'm king shit of fuck mountain." So, you know,
yeah, you can see it. I like Bradley Woodford in this movie, if only because we never see him like this. Like the beginning of his career with this and Billy Madison. That's a completely different acting career than where The West Wing ultimately takes him as an actor. And I think it's fascinating whenever I see somebody give a performance, because he's basically playing like a hard ass here. I always love seeing Costner play bad guys. And it's, I think, a tribute to his acting ability that the audience almost is tricked into liking him while Philip is being tricked into liking him. I love that the restaurant eats at with the sexy lady is called Dottie's Squat and Gobble. That is Texas as fuck, and I hope that places like that actually exist. I wish Laura Dern had more to do in this movie. Yeah. I wish her character was more central to the like solving this case.
She has all this cool like ability to like to like do like know what's going on, and it doesn't factor ever So yeah, it's annoying.
Was really disappointing. I think this movie has a lot to say about abusive parents, abusive fathers, and why that made Butch into the person he is, and that ultimately is his downfall, but also his desire to help Philip, because Philip doesn't have a father and he wants to give Philip something that neither of them have had. But he gets so angry at Mac about what he perceives to be abusive behavior. I'll call it abusive behavior. And if he'd just leave, like, the movie could go on another 2.5 hours. Like, mm-hmm. but because he's so hell-bent on what he perceives to be justice, even though it's a warped view of justice, that's what ultimately brings him down and ultimately teaches Philip who Butch really is. I think there's some powerful stuff in there to chew on. I don't personally have experience with an abusive father, but I know people who do. And, you know, I imagine this movie speaks to them on a level it doesn't speak to me. that's all the notes that I wrote down. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it this time around. Aaron?
Yeah, I had a blast watching it again, and it's been a while for me as well. There are many reasons I think this movie succeeds for me. You mentioned several of them, including the overall themes of child abuse. Basically, the movie goes out of its way to show all the different forms of ways that parents can damage their children, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's scene after scene of these things, and a lot of that has to do with our protagonist. It has to do with, you know, why he became who he was, like you mentioned. But you know, even like we haven't mentioned the kid worrying about the size of his penis thing, like running gag that happens in this movie, which is shocking, you know, to watch now, because that would never be in a movie, you know, now at all. but it does speak to something about how parents can put the simplest idea in their kid's head, and it becomes this thing that defines them, right? And it shows the difference between a harsh word and an encouraging word in a very weird and extremely inappropriate way. But it's purposeful in that way, as is so much of the movie and what it's trying to say about, you know, how parents damage their children and impact their children. So yeah, I think this movie has a very clear message and theme. I think this movie succeeds a lot on chemistry. I think there are a lot of great charismatic people doing great work together. But I also think Costner and this kid are so good together.
Yeah.
And there are moments when things happen and the kid smiles that I'm just like, just give me this, buddy. Like, you know, I know we're trying to figure out like the nuances of adult-child relationships and, you know, inspiring children at the same time as the negative messages that we give them. But them together, there's just something really magical, and you get a sense both for how this kid just wants a father figure, just wants somebody to play that role in his life, and also how much the Costner character needs it as a lesson on what it means to be that figure, having, you know, not been it. So they fill this role for each other that's, I think, really beautiful. Some specific things. The scene, there's a scene that reminds me of one of my very first like sin brain moments, because when the trailer separates from the truck, there's this joke where all of a sudden the trailer is riding beside the truck. Mm-hmm. It's the same joke from like an old Herbie movie where Herbie splits in half and the back half like catches up to the front half. I just remember thinking as a kid, like, but how does the back half catch up to the front half? It should be slowing down. Anyways, so that just reminded me of that. This is in medias res beginning before that was kind of every movie. Mm. Like, this was probably one of the first movies that I remember doing that. I bet you're wondering how I got here kind of start. And so I thought that was worth mentioning. It's also kind of one of my first experiences with really grappling with the nuances of an anti-hero, right? The idea of, do I like this guy? Do I not like this guy? How terrible is this guy? The movie tries, I think, very valiantly to set him up with maybe the world's most mustache twirly villain in the history of movies. Like, that guy is like pure evil. Yeah. And then Bradley Whitford, by the way, plays that role in the second half. They kind of like trade off, like, we're the, you know, the nasty guy for the movie. And so, you know, they try to play him off of him. They give Laura Dern a line about, you know, how he's a criminal's criminal, you know, that it's not violent crime, that kind of stuff. But he has killed people, and he does kill Terry, and the stuff he does to that family at the end is terrible, and I think we need to see that, and of course the kid needs to see that. And so there is really this thing of, like, you know, wrestling with the nuance of ideas of redemption, ideas of humanity, ideas of what causes people to the actions that they take. And yeah, I mean, antiheroes have become just synonymous with pop culture anymore, but you know, back whatever it was now, 32 years or whatever it is, you know, I don't think there were quite as many antiheroes in cinema. They were there, but it certainly wasn't the norm. So yeah, it was interesting, remembering that. Let's see. So there's this moment where he puts the kid on top of the car and I'm just like, what are we doing? This is terrible. And then I'm just like, yeah, they've been having the kid. He had the kid hold a gun.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And yet he puts him on top of the car and I'm like, you terrible child endangerment person, you. That was an interesting thing. And then, when the kid says, probably my favorite moment of the movie, just made me laugh, when the kid says, kiss her backside, huh? just in the midst of conversation. Well,
and then he's like, did you love her? And he was like, yeah, I loved her. Kissed her butt, didn't I?
And they both laughed together. And again, it's that example of that chemistry they have that I just think really makes the movie sing. So, I had a really good time watching it again. It's very 90s. You know, there's some tropey stuff in it, and the ending does go on a little bit. But I don't know, there's some good stuff in that ending too that I think really builds the emotion. I think Clint thought it would be more tense filled than it really is. The tension doesn't quite hold for the whole thing. I think there's some good stuff in there too.
I kept going, you're using a megaphone and he's just shouting. Exactly how far apart are you guys? Like,
right.
It doesn't make sense that you can hear him if you need to use the megaphone for him to hear you. Anyway.
Yeah, I think what you guys all touched on, things that I was thinking during this. I also thought it was fun, by the way. I don't know if this was on purpose, but the fact that they went to a clothing store called Friendly's, and then you can find a Casper the Friendly Ghost costume there and everything, I thought was kind of fun. I had not seen this movie in a really long time. I'm glad that it mostly held up to my memory and everything, but there are some things in this movie, because I was like, they're like doing the whole thing with them going through the field after he goes through the barbed wire. I was looking down at the time and it was like 1:50 or something like that, and there's still like 25 minutes left at that point. And I was like, how can they possibly put 25 minutes at this point? This feels like it's got 10 minutes, not 25 minutes. But all right, let's go on to the super secret double features.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you, most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Well, I've got two, and so I'm afraid I'll. Do you have multiples in case I take yours?
I've got two that I want to talk about for sure, and a six total on my list. So you're
all right. Great. I'll go first then. I went on the nose this time. I just think there are two just like perfect examples of, you know, double features for this movie. And I think the one that really sticks out to me is Road to Perdition.
I thought about this one.
I know it's on the nose. But it is so perfect.
Shame
to me because
on you.
It both encapsulates the relationship between adults and children and the impact that has on them. Mm-hmm. And also the journey of the adults and children are so similar in this movie. It's really a very symmetrical watch when you watch these two movies together. So, yeah, I went ahead and went with Road to Perdition.
Road to Perdition crossed my mind. It's really, really good as a double feature. The only reason I didn't have it on my list is that I double featured it with Untouchables a few weeks ago or whatever, and I just don't want to repeat so frequently. There are two movies where Jeff Bridges plays a Texas Ranger who is chasing a fugitive across a southern state. Hell or High Water and True Grit. I ended up going with True Grit because it has the crotchety older guy and a child on the journey, bonding and coming to care about each other. And then, you know, also allows me to do the Mr. LaBrief. Hell or High Water would be a good double feature. Again, set in Texas, again, chasing fugitives across Texas. One of the fugitives is a criminal's criminal, and one of them is a insane murderer person. But I ultimately thought that adult-child relationship was a huge part of what Perfect World was about. So I'm going with True Grit. It's Mr. LaBeef.
Nice.
Even though this was my pick this week, I actually thought of Cop Car as well.
That's on my list.
For the double feature, if I had been tasked to come up with one,
I toyed for a good 5 minutes with going with Waterworld.
Oh.
Fair enough. The other one I thought was a good pick was Leon the Professional.
Yep, yeah, I had that on my list.
Another good one.
Yeah, has a lot of the same themes.
Okay. What is our homework for next week? I believe it's Jeremy's turn. So
my turn. We're going.
Jeremy,
back.
What are we
going
to watch next week?
Going back to friend of the show, Gavin O'Connor, who directed the movie Warrior, and we're going to watch another of my favorite sports movies of all time, Miracle, about 1980 Miracle on Ice in Lake Placid, U.S. hockey team. This is, in my opinion, a top five sports movie for me, and I have not seen it in probably 7 or 8 years. And I know that it's an incredible Kurt Russell performance, but also a great ensemble cast, and I'm looking forward to getting back into it. And that is on Disney Plus, for those of you looking for the free watch option, or rentable on all your usual streaming renting places.
Jeremy, what did you think of The Way Back, speaking of Gavin O'Connor?
That's the one
movies.
With
Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck. I liked it a lot. I think... what I remember saying is that it was hard to watch Affleck, an alcoholic, play an alcoholic.
Yeah, sure.
Every time he was drinking in that, I just kept thinking, man, this can't have been a healthy role for him to play. And it was distracting enough that it probably kept me from really getting into the film. But I liked the performances. It's a solid, sports, the coach needs the team kind of film. So
cool.
This is one of the few classic sporting events that I have watched beginning to finish. Like they've actually, they replayed it. I obviously didn't watch it live when it happened. I was like 3 years old when this happened. but I actually have watched this full game before. I don't do that very often. It's how impactful it is. And this movie's really good. I can't wait to revisit it. All right, looks like we have some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
Question one. If someone came to visit your hometown/home state who'd never been there, what movie, TV, cultural touchstone would you be excited to introduce them to?
Man, this is tough in Springfield, Missouri. Recently Chappelle Roan, who is from here, and has recorded some of her music videos here, she's blown up. So that's probably
pronounced that. It's supposed to be pronounced Chappelle.
Chapel. It's Chapel. I just get it wrong.
Look, here's the deal. I read most of the world. I don't hear it, right? And so,
Chris, tell us how it's pronounced. How is it pronounced, Chris?
I don't know. I'm not a fan. I've heard of her. I've always said Chapel Roan in my head,
Well, I have too. But I've never heard it pronounced. Just like
me either.
Like when the Kardashians first started getting big, I wasn't hearing it about. I didn't watch E. I was seeing headlines on like news apps and whatnot, and that is not how I pronounce that name.
for several years until I heard it pronounced correctly.
I think it is Chapel Roan. I think I pronounced it incorrectly. Anyways, that's a recent one, but the one that always sticks out to me is a very, take a still shot from the movie moment in Jason Bourne, where it shows that his hometown is Nixa, Missouri. This is a tiny town right here in the Springfield area, in the Ozarks area. It's like 15 minutes from me. That somebody literally built a road sign that said "Home of Jason Bourne" and attached it below the population "Welcome to Nixa" sign.
That's awesome.
Because I mean, who would have thought Nixa, Missouri? That was where Jason Bourne was born.
Bourne. I live in Nashville, right? So I guess I'd take it to the Bluebird Cafe and wax philosophical about the thing called love, maybe. I could take you to the intersection from Percy Jackson, where they go the wrong direction even though they're trying to go to the Parthenon. the Parthenon, that's a good one. Even though I don't know if it's been in a lot of films, it has been in a couple, and that's, I think it's like the tallest statue of Athena east of the Mississippi.
It's a pretty faithful recreation down to the Athena statue that's inside of it and everything. I had included that in my answer. You had you wrote something like which hometown, and you didn't know where to start, and you went like Music Row, Bluebird Cafe, and stuff like that. Percy Jackson has the Parthenon. The movie Nashville has the Parthenon. Those are all good. I would say I often consider my hometown to be Franklin, Tennessee, though, and they filmed a movie there called At Close Range that David Foley directed, has Sean Penn and Christopher Walken. This was back in the 80s. Sean Penn had just married Madonna, and apparently Franklin was swarmed with paparazzi during the time because Sean Penn and Madonna were married, just happened. I was only 9, so I was not aware of paparazzi going around Franklin or anything at the time. But there's a lot of things in it at Close Range that have all sorts of hometown landmarks. And of course, you look at it 30 plus years later, a lot of that stuff has changed dramatically, but it has my future high school in it. There's like scenes at my future high school in At Close Range. There's a shot of there's a scene where Christopher Walken shows Sean Penn how to buy a car at one place and sell it for more money at another place. Basically goes to one place on this it's Hillsborough Road, and goes to this car dealership, buys it, drives directly across the street to another car dealership and sells it for more money. At Close Range is a pretty good movie, but it's got the Franklin Square in it. It's got all sorts of stuff in it. So yeah, that's the one I would go with.
I think this question touches on something really interesting for me, which is like when you guys, have traveled or whatever, do you seek out like movie locations or like places from, stuff?
You at least appreciate it when you see it. Like I remember when we were in Chicago in 2015, we saw a couple different landmarks. Like I think we saw the circular parking garage from The Dark Knight. From the outside, and we stayed in the hotel where The Fugitive shot the ending, which the hotel is happy to remind you about in every elevator. But I love that kind of stuff. I love, when I was in college, we went to Chicago all the time, but going to the, whatever the art museum is called, where they go and Ferris Bueller and, seeing some of the stuff that they see, always wow. Like Matthew Broderick, who was a pain in the ass on Glory, was right in the spot.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's this thing also, once you've been somewhere and then you see it in movies all the time and you're like, oh, I know what that geography is like. Like, I've stood in that 3D space, just being in the UK for a little bit recently, I'll see these UK TV shows and I'll be like, I've ridden on a bus just like that double-decker bus. You know, like, there's something different about having, like, experienced what you're seeing. It adds an element of investment for me. It's really
I will
weird.
Let you in on a little, just a slice of what big, ginormous dorks my wife and I are. But whenever we're watching a show or a movie and we see a place that one or both of us have been in real life, we say, I've been there. But it's evolved over the years to, like, we say, I've been there. We don't even say like that proper grammar. We say it like a toddler would say it. A bender. Anyway, there you go.
That's amazing.
Going over to the chat, Link says Breaking Bad, which suggests New Mexico. Mm. Slab says, I hate that my best option is Twister. And he later says Oklahoma, going to the Twister Museum, I guess. Nolan says, I grew up in Melville, New York, birthplace of Walt Whitman, so I guess Leaves of Grass is what I'd go with. Mm. Let's see. Shaggy says, Chicago, take your pick. I do love that Hoffa was filmed really close to where I grew up. Link says, also one of the Transformers movies was filmed here. James says, Moonrise Kingdom. I've had more than one picnic date at that titular cave. Cove.
Wow.
Lolly says, well, my home county is where they filmed a bunch of some little film I only saw once called The Princess Bride. let's see. Then I guess she also says, I guess for hometown, I'm sorry for gendering people. I don't really know a lot of times who what everybody is, but I'm assuming a lot of times, so I'm sorry. I guess the hometown may be the Derby part of Damned United. Shaggy asks, what about Ashley Judd? Well, if you want to go find Ashley Judd, then you're on your own on that one.
Yeah, I'm not going to take you to her.
Right. I believe
like
a lot
landmark.
Right. I believe a lot of celebrities live in the Leaper's Fork area. So if you want to like drive around Leaper's Fork and you happen to run into celebrity, there you go.
Does Nicole Kidman spend a lot of time in Nashville?
Actually,
she does.
Yeah.
She and her husband both have for a long time, but I read a couple weeks ago that they're apparently thinking about moving to Australia. So
Well, they're both from Australia, so you know, it makes sense. But yeah, that's one I've never had. I've never had a Nicole Kidman sighting when I've been out here, but I know a lot of people who have, so you know that they do get around and show their faces quite a bit. So let's see. What's your favorite full needle drop in a movie? The song plays in its entirety. I didn't know that's what you call a needle drop.
I didn't understand the question. Shit.
But.
I can go first then.
Yeah, go ahead.
I love the use of Clair de Lune in Ocean's 11, and the whole song plays. It is such an interesting counterpoint to kind of what we're experiencing, because it is both the relief of the end of the job, but it's also this moment of sacrifice that Danny Ocean, you know, is making going to prison or whatever. And the way it's incorporated into the rhythm of those final 5 minutes is just, I think it's a masterclass in using music.
Yeah, it really is.
So I love Clair de Lune in Ocean's 11.
It was early in my movie going, my movie going days that I remember and everything. I remember seeing Lean on Me in theaters, and they play the entire Guns N' Roses Welcome to the Jungle at the very beginning of that movie.
Wow.
And 13-year-old me was like, hell fucking yeah, they played the whole song. Hell yeah. And it was really cool when they did that. Anyway, Jeremy, what do you think? Do you have an answer?
Do they play all of Wake Up in the end credits of The Matrix? Do they play that whole song?
Like, I think they do.
Sure,
I think
why
they
not?
Do.
Let's just assume they do, because I love that needle drop when it's like, wee, 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 and he flies up into the sky and it's like, I love Rage Against the Machine like 5 minutes at a time. Like, I couldn't sit and listen to an entire Rage album because I would just, it's too much. But in 5-minute doses, that'll be my answer, even if the whole thing doesn't play.
And I mean, and you know, and even credits, they'll cut off the song a lot of times, right. But I think they played the full thing there, and it's always a cool thing. If you're an usher, to get hear a cool song for the whole time while you're throwing cups and popcorn bags into a trash can and everything. Shaggy says, Beetlejuice had a bad one. I agree with this, by the way. I hated that they played that full song in that. It took forever. Yeah, MacArthur Park, exactly. But Slab says, shut up, I liked it. James says, recency bias, but Benjamin Britten in Challengers was unexpectedly tender. I actually don't remember, but I do remember the music in Challengers was pretty good.
Well, so. They just won a Golden Globe for the score, and it's Atticus whatever. And
Oh, yeah, Trent Reznor and Trent Atticus Reznor. Ross.
But I don't know who Benjamin Britten is. What is that? I've seen Challengers twice, but I don't know what that's talking about.
I don't either.
I have opinions on that movie, but I'll save it for the
He's a composer of some sort, though, and I'm sure it's a song that Benjamin Britten did, so I don't remember. Slab says, fine, Bell Bottoms from Baby Driver. Well, yeah, that's a great one, obviously.
That is a great one.
Really, really good one. Kastrof says, is it 100 miles and running? I don't know. 100 miles and running in Free Guy. I guess not actually the full song, but close enough. No, it's not. Has to be the full song, guys. Wrong. No, that totally works. Shaggy says maybe Reservoir Dogs. Is that the Steelers Wheel song that he plays when he cuts the gear off?
It's got to be. Yeah. Stuck in the Middle with You.
Stuck in the Middle with You, yeah. And then, James verifies that Benjamin Britten is a classical composer during the Windy Kiss scene. And then Nolan, the song at the end of Jason Bourne, Extreme Ways by Moby. Yes, absolutely. My favorite moment of Extreme Ways is when I believe is it Ultimatum where we think he's dead at the end?
In the water,
And they tell Julia Stiles is watching the news and they don't find the body, and he goes, it coincides with her recognition that he's not dead. Fucking love
his body in the water starts swimming slowly.
I've
told this story before, but I turned to my wife at exactly that moment and said, I immediately want to buy more tickets and watch this movie again.
Man, that Bourne series, fucking great. Unbelievable good stuff. Anyway, what a great way to end our show today. Next week will be Miracle. Once again, I'd like to thank chat for coming out here and watching us today. Thank you so much. Very happy that you came out and waited through all the holidays and everything for our comeback. And we'll see you next week. See ya.
Bye, everybody. See ya.
Bye.
See ya.
Believe in miracles.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
I like that
doing?
Voice. You should do that voice more. It sounds a little like Sling Blade.
It's my Beetlejuice voice.
I like mustard on my biscuits.
Some people call it a Kaiser Blade. I call it a Sling Blade.
Beetle Sluice.
Are you guys excited for tonight?
Excited for tonight? The answer would be no, because I'm not sure what you're talking about.
That was kind of my test. I didn't figure either one of you were clued in to what tonight is. But tonight is the debut of the new indoor tech-infused golf league started by Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy, where they play. There are six teams, but only two teams play each time. And, of course, Tiger and Rory are not playing on the opening night. That makes no sense. They hit all their tee shots and fairway shots with this ginormous simulator that all the players are saying is the most accurate thing they've ever played with. Then, when they get within 50 yards, they turn around, and they have a green with real sand bunkers that can spin 360 degrees and change undulation on the fly. So the green, and it's the size of a basketball court, so the green can be hundreds of different setups. Hmm. And they chip two and putt, and apparently they're a little fast, but the roll is very true. And so they have an arena that they've built specifically for this. They've got cameras that are supposed to do really wicked cool Matrix shit. And then they've got a few thousand people in there that I think they're going to rile up, like, you know, wrestling style. I don't know, not wrestling style, but I think they're going to get them all, like, pumped up. And then, yeah, they do this team-based thing. They play 15 holes instead of 18. Like, the golf world is completely split on whether this is going to be amazing or suck. And I can't wait to find out.
I have always, this is impossible, by the way, what I'm about to talk about, but that I have always felt like sports like golf and disc golf and everything would benefit greatly if they would be able to be played at night and have prime time hours and everything. Mm. But it's impossible. You'd have to light a whole golf course, like, completely. Like, you can't just leave some stuff dark. You have to, like, light it completely. Yeah. But I've always thought it would be cool. I think especially disc golf would benefit greatly from a primetime event that, you know, that instead of you watching it during the day and it competes with actual golf during the, you know, the summer and everything, you could have, like, a, you know, an indoor. Now, indoor would be impossible too, but it would just be, it'd be fun to have, like, a whole indoor course. You'd have to have a mega, you'd have to have a mega structure to do that type of thing. But
somebody's gonna do it, right? They just they're building a huge indoor pickleball, like, facility in Nashville. Like, but pickleball is not the same as disc golf. But
yeah, I just keep thinking you're gonna have to have approaches that are 300 to 400 yards, and disc golf even longer because they can toss these things so far now. Mm. Even if you tried to, like, interwind it, you know, where you're trying to keep it smaller to reduce costs to build an indoor facility, it still would be ridiculous how big that place would have to be to do it. But, like, I keep thinking how cool that'd be.
There's probably three of them in Dubai already. yeah, I think that's kind of like what putt-putt was supposed to be for golf. Like, the idea that you could shrink it down, maybe put it inside if you wanted to.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything like that for disc golf. You know, like, putting in disc golf is really boring.
Yeah, seriously. Imagine every hole on a miniature disc golf course, you're like 5 feet away from the...
Yeah.
And there's a clown mouth you have to shoot it through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Whenever we were... when I was a kid, putt-putt was freaking huge, right? Like, I think... That might have been a generational thing. There's still mini golf, but it's not anywhere near as popular. And they had Holiday Inns across America they called holodomes that had, like, big pools and arcades and mini golf inside. And, man, you take us to one of those, like, mom and dad don't have to plan anything for me and my brother for the whole time that we're there. We'll just play mini golf for 12 straight hours. And we did. It was awesome. Hey, the another reason I'm excited, even though I'm not going to watch it tonight, for today, is that movie Flow is now available to rent on demand.
Oh, nice.
And I'm very excited about seeing the post-apocalyptic kitty and his animal friends.
I have a couple interesting things with that. Number one, I recently filled out my Critics' Choice ballot, and it's in there for Best Foreign Language Film.
Oh, wow.
There's no spoken language in the movie, but it comes from a different country. And it got me thinking, like, maybe we need to rename that category or something. Like, well, you know, because they're...
Didn't the Oscars call it international at one point?
International feature, I think, at one point.
But now they call it foreign language. It used to be just foreign film, you know, whatever. But
something like that. I'd have to look it up to be sure.
It does seem like international would be a better... course of action, considering there's going to be some, like you say, that don't have any language in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. You're going to love it, Jeremy. It's one of those I'm fairly confident you're going
to
love.
I watched the trailer and immediately showed it to my wife, and we both are dying to watch it. It'll probably be this weekend.
Like, yeah. Is it like an adaptation of Stray or something?
No, but it...
Basically, no, visually it is. It looks like it.
It has nothing to do with it, but yeah, it very much looks like that.
that game, by the way, I beat that game a couple of years ago. And,
oh, yeah?
And yeah, it was one of those where I think I'd played it at Jeremy's house for a while one day. And then I got the bug to play it during the hiatus I had a couple of years ago. And so I played it. And it's not a hard game. I love the little puzzles and stuff that they throw in there and whatever. But that game is mostly about mood. It really puts you in this sort of like, I don't know. It's there's something. You really do feel like you're in a completely different world and everything. They did a really good job with that. I don't know what the ultimate verdict was from gamers about that game, but I really enjoyed it.
No, I think it was generally well reviewed and well received.
If they do, they should just make the sequel The Plot of Flow.
Yeah.
And just you can play the movie.
Yeah.
So you've got golf on TV, you've got cats in your movies. Mm-hmm. Like, it is a day for you.
I'm telling
Jeremy.
You, I was absolutely ready to hijack these outtakes with my big day, because I've been actually looking forward to it for, well, I think I found out 3 days ago that Flow was going to be available, but I've known the golf thing for a couple weeks was going to be on the 7th, and I hope it doesn't suck. But I recognize that I don't understand why Tiger and Rory are not playing in the very first inaugural
match. Yeah, it makes
match.
No sense.
They're the faces of the league. They own the league. Tiger just played 2 weeks ago with his son. He can play. So it's not injury related. Like, why would you not? And I'm sure they're probably going to be there, but still, it makes no sense to me from a marketing standpoint.
Yeah. It does seem like you would want to have your very best that you could get possibly in that to, you know.
That's what Steph Curry always shows up on that Extreme Putt-Putt show.
What? That sentence makes no sense to me. What the hell are you saying?
And I didn't know until recently was that Rob Riggle was a Marine or Army something, whatever, before he even got into, you know, before he got that Daily Show gig and then, you know, started showing up in all the comedy movies and everything. I didn't realize. It was like, I think it was right after 9/11 he signed up or something like that. And he went, I had no idea about that until like just very recently.
Holy Moly is the name of the show, and there have been 4 seasons, and I've watched them all and enjoyed them.
Holy moly. I tell you what, I have no idea what's going on network TV. I'm just not ever paying attention to those channels.
This says it's on Netflix. Maybe it's on Netflix now. I thought it was ABC, but maybe it's. Of course, then why wouldn't it be on Hulu? I don't know. Anyways.
That's one thing I've noticed about network TV, though, is like even when there's something that comes up that's like, oh, I might want to watch that actually. That looks really good. And then you watch it and it's like, oh, this is exactly like every network show that I remember leaving before. It's okay. It's good for what it is for certain.
Sure.
It's just that all those familiar things that pop up that they always do in every single thing, you're like, oh, this seemed pretty fun and original, and then you just put all the stuff in it that just is like every other show, and I can't watch anymore now.
I feel like you're describing Abbott Elementary, because that's basically my experience with that show, where it's like, this is a great, funny show, but like all the tropes are there.
Yeah, you know? I've seen that show once, I think. What was the one? It's that one that Caitlin Olsen. Was it Caitlin? Is it Caitlin Olsen? The one
Not
from
sure.
Always Sunny. Her name is not Caitlin Olsen. Her name is Caitlin Olsen. Yeah, Caitlin Olsen.
Zaxby's just out Philly the Philly again. The Zaxby's Chicken Philly is back with garlic aioli, sauteed peppers and onions, decadent melty cheese, and your choice of Zaxby's signature crispy chicken fingers or delicious grilled chicken. But it's only back for a limited time, so enjoy it while you can. No pressure. It's just the greatest sandwich of all time on a ticking clock. Order the Chicken Philly today. Who's got the sauce? Zaxby's.